Well, here we are. The year is 2024. As I write these words and gaze out at London, I cannot help but wonder at the city's resilience. I mean, a few years ago, the most massive and devastating pandemic in modern times hit this city really hard. COVID changed all our lives, either via the loss of family and friends or simply the impact of isolating. For some, the isolation was a terrible time, causing intense loneliness. For others, maybe people like myself who find social interaction difficult, we kind of miss it. But crucially, and most significantly, here we are today and the whole thing is a memory. In a few short years, look how London has moved on. The news as I write this episode is interesting. Mayor Sadiq Khan is considering installing a small tourist surcharge in London's hotels. Christmas lights are being turned on in Oxford Street and in Covent Garden. And even buildings like the Shard are having their own Christmas light celebrations. And the pandemic has faded into our collective memories as we watch the world around us with fascination and slight bewilderment. And I mention all of this to help illustrate a point. How robust London is. How within a few years after such a massive pandemic, London is moving forward for good and for bad and getting on with life. And way back 674 years ago, in the year 1350, London was doing the same. The Black Death had struck the city, causing devastation and, well, death, disrupting lives and changing futures. Yet the perseverance and endurance of the city prevailed. London got back to getting on with their lives. Or they tried to. The problem was, unlike, say, 2020, the aftermath of the pandemic in 1350 was much longer lasting and much more profound. And the aftermath of the plague was to cause for London a massive economic and political change. The city is about to come under attack in a way it had thought it had seen off years before, and once again the rights and privileges of the oligarchs of London were to be removed. And this was to cause a huge tectonic shift in London's politics, creating new ways of organising, new factions, new alliances, new covenants. Paradoxically as well, these changes also offered one heck of a lifeline to the city. As London became the focus of a new wave of economic migrants, newcomers who flocked to the city, their children and grandchildren would in time shape and focus the story of London in generations to come. This was a fascinating few years for the city, as the survivors of the plague suddenly realised that what was no more. They were in a new world. New political orders had to arise. New alliances had to be made. New covenants had to be established. Hi there, my name is Saul, your host and narrator of this, The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the history of the city in chronological sequence. Each chapter stands alone and can be listened to as a one-off, but taken together, present a massive narrative story of this city on the River Thames. And this week we have reached chapter 124 of the story, covering the 7 or so years after the first outbreak of the plague. Welcome, then, to Engrossers. So what follows, I must admit, is a complicated mix of social history, political history, and economic history. And not always the most exciting material on earth, I must admit. And as such, I'm taking the work of much more learned and brilliant academics, and I'm simplifying what they wrote into what I hope is an easily explainable narrative that you find interesting. If anything I say sounds a bit dense and complicated, please note this is genuinely a simplification of a much more complex tale. And with that said, let's begin with a simple truth. Immediately after the plague in England died down, inflation skyrocketed. Today we can understand this easily. The staggering number of deaths had caused a massive contraction in the labour market. As many as one-third of all working-age adults had died, possibly more. And this was not localised in one area. It was everywhere across the nation and across Europe. This manpower shortage led to a shortage in goods, thus driving up the prices of those goods. It also drove up wages, as less workers could and did demand better pay. Inflation, therefore, started to go up. In response to this, well, during the outbreak, as we covered last episode, King Edward III introduced his Ordinances of Labourers that forced wages to go down to 1346 level. And yet, while keeping wages down, he did allow for inflationary pressures to begin to drive up prices. This suddenly left workers out of pocket. And these changes, coupled with him insisting that wages and the payment of wages should be strictly regulated, created a total mess. Now, the reason it was such a mess was because basically, in the 14th century, no one really understood language about the economics of inflation at all. Rather, they blamed instead, as always, profiteers. People, they called at the time, quote, engrossers and regrators, unquote. Now, regular listeners may know that the term regrator I have mentioned in a previous chapter. This was the name they gave to people who made their money by buying up loads of a particular commodity so as to corner the market and then sell it on to Londoners. Previous regrators of London had to limit their activities after a certain time during the day. Regrator was a term used to describe this practice and those who did it. To which is now joined this new term, engrosser, and these are men who do the same thing, particularly in the fish and wine trade. Now, we know that inflation was rising insanely fast in the aftermath of the plague. Such inflation hit the nerves and budgets of the king, his nobility, and the gentry across the country. The Parliament, which sat at Westminster in February 1351, experienced close hand, as did the king, the soaring cost of living in London, and this shocked the living daylights out of them. I mean, within 6 years of the plague, we estimate that the inflation rate was almost at 100%. And back in 1351, the great and the good of England sought a fast solution. They concluded that the only remedy to the inflation in London was to remove those continuing commercial privileges which, since 1335, had set the city apart from other English urban communities. No longer should London be exempt from something called the Statute of York. Foreign merchants and merchants from the rest of England should be allowed to trade freely in London, whether in the wholesale trade, the retail trade, or the lucrative distributive trade. The reasoning went that by opening London's trade to all competition, then the stranglehold of the organised trade crafts of London would be broken, and then prices would fall. In a nutshell, regardless of whatever else was going on, regardless of fixing wages at 1346 levels, the powers of England all concluded that London itself was responsible for the rising prices in London, and it was time to take the city's privileges and powers away from them. Now, to regular listeners, this may sound like history repeating itself. And frankly, it was. This was the battlefield upon which generations of Londoners previously had fought before. Countless times I have described the rise and fall of London's trading rights and privileges. Indeed, between chapters 112 and 117, I dedicated all of those to try and give credit to the 30-year campaign to defend those ancient privileges against King Edward II. But this was different. This was a new world. In the decades up to now, the game of defending the rights of London's merchants was played by the rich men of London and the Crown. There were many sides to this debate. The city could play off nobles or the commons of the city. It was an endless back and forth dance of influence, politics and agitation. As far back as the reign of King John, and even before that to the reigns of King Stephen or even Henry I, London's principal political focus had been the protection and maintenance of these rules and regulations, the privileges, the franchise of London. And here we are again. in 1351. And guess what? They're under attack. But as I said, this is a new world, a world after the Great Plague, a world born out of such vast death and destruction, a world where old covenants of the city were broken. Now the nobles and the king were acting as one. This was a parliamentary decree. There was no dissent, no games they could play, no strategies to fall back on. All that effort and work in the 1120s and 1130s to repeal things like the Carta Mercatoria was now meaningless. It was done. And to the crafts of London, this was a calamity as great as the plague itself. This was, economically at least, apocalyptical. Although the Londoners included in their franchise and still retain things like freedom from tolls around the country, another chartered right, what the freemen of London had come to identify most closely with the term, and what they were to guard most jealously because it affected their daily livelihood, were those commercial privileges which kept foreigners and unenfranchised Englishmen out of the retail and distributive trade off London. But be that as it may, the powers that be had decided that London had to lose these powers. Of course, this didn't stop London from trying to prevent this crisis or work endlessly to try to restore their old rights. And at the beginning of this crisis, into the story comes two figures to try and help lead London out of it. These were two new community leaders. One was a roper called Richard de Wickham, and he was joined by a Soper's Lane pepperer called John de Weston. And these two seem to have been the leading advocates of what was a bright idea. Why not simply pay the king to restore the franchise and rights of London? I mean, that had kind of worked in the past, am I right? The basic idea was to send a petition to the king, asking the king to not impose the Statute of York upon London and to help influence his decision. London would loan the king 20,000 marks of silver. Now, John de Weston had begun life as a roper himself before moving into the spice trade. And in 1338, during events we covered back in chapter 119, he was chosen by the Ward of Dowgate, along with some other ropers, to guard the city in the king's absence. He was obviously already a mature man, and in time he became one of the wardens of London Bridge, in company with his fellow roper, Richard de Wickham. So it was Richard de Wickham who went with a small group of the aldermen and members of the commonalty to the king to signify the city's agreement to a loan of 20,000 marks, and Weston was one of the 12 assessors chosen to raise this sum for the crown. These two men were part of a citywide determination by the citizens to protect their trade against the prospect of losing the control they had. Proof there was a wider campaign? Well, that year, for the third time, the Alderman of London now made Andrew Aubrey mayor. He'd been in business as a pepperer for at least 30 years, and for 17 of them as an alderman, and had twice held the position of mayor. He had already proven his strength of character and his capacity for leadership. Within a month of his election as mayor, Aubrey ordered the chief crafts guilds of the city to elect four representatives to meet him and the aldermen and the sheriffs to discuss, quote, certain important business, unquote, touching upon the state of the city. Of the 19 crafts who were named, the spices are listed second only to the drapers. The result of this meeting was that the craft groups were ordered to present the names of their elected representatives at the Guildhall on the 10th of November 1351. The drapers and 9 other guilds elected 4 representatives, and the spicers, mercers and fishmongers elected 6. As an important side note, which I'll come back to in a moment, out of those 6 spicers, 3 of them were Soper's Lane pepperers, 2 were ropers from Dowgate, and 1 was an apothecary from up on Cheapside, all working together. Now, I have to say that some specialist historians who love this era read an awful lot into this election of these representatives of the guilds, suggesting it was an attempt by the crafts to take over the Common Council of London and make themselves more important than the ward representatives. Chances are it wasn't. This was Mayor Aubrey summoning the representatives of the crafts to consult them about what affected them most, namely the loss of the city's commercial privileges. That loan of 20,000 marks to the king, it seems, had already been organised through the crafts because their representatives were chosen to assess the contributions. So basically, these were showing a growing, increasing political power. However, clearly in the eyes of the commonality, Weston and Richard de Wickham had been responsible for organising the loan to the king, because when it failed to win back the lost commercial privileges, both men were apparently arrested, imprisoned and charged with raising a loan without the commonality's consent. The arrests didn't stick, and both men were released, but it does make us wonder, why did the commonality turn on these two? Now, the Soper's Lane pepperer, John de Weston, was clearly no pro-royalist. Only a few months before this loan, he'd been accused with others of making, quote, citations, appeals, inhibitions and other instruments prejudicial to the king, unquote, in a court case. And it is possible that actually the reason he got involved was part of a larger personal campaign aimed at establishing him as a leader in the commonality. And it does beg the question, before we go any further, why did this Weston move to Soper's Lane and become a spicer immediately after the plague, considering he'd been a roper? That actually reveals quite a bit about some of the internal politics of London in the post-pandemic era. He was obviously still on good terms with his fellow ropers, some of whom he was appointed in 1351 to make inquiries into the goods of the German merchants in the steelyard. And it does seem to be that the aim of Weston and Wickham's plan was in principle to restore the franchise in order to protect the ropers and the spices trade. And as a manifestation of the increasing ties between the two trades, you have Weston moving to Soper's Lane. He was a roper taking advantage of the new openings in that quarter created by the deaths of pepperers in the plague. Weston, using these opportunities given to him by the plague, soon showed themselves afterwards. In 1350-52, he supplied the royal wardrobe with large quantities of wax, rice and almonds, moving into a market usually dominated by the Italians. Now, for Weston, he knew that in order to continue the success, he needed the recovery of London's franchise. So this is why he was probably behind it. But when the loan to the king failed to reach its object, the commonality said he'd only said this loan because of his links to the royal wardrobe and he was an inside man working for the king. The spicers and the pepperers, however, knew the man better. They kept faith with him, and in July 1357, the fraternity of pepperers chose him as one of their wardens. Weston was both someone to stand up to the king and the commonality of London. And where am I going with all of this? Well, in short, we see that during this era, not only did London fail to remove the loss of power, residents were having to plan for a future without of it. In short, the changes ordered by the king in 1351 actually stimulated political organisation and activity in London. We see this in small but fascinating details. For example, that fraternity of pepperers I just mentioned, that was actually the fraternity of the parish church of St. Antonine. Now, these were dealers in pepper and spices who had bonded together via their local parish church. Its members became the profession's representatives on the Common Council. The fraternity grew. By 1351, new members joined the fraternity, denoting its authority over other pepperers beyond the parish of St. Antonine. Four of them were spicers based upon Cheapside, and it seems clear they joined as a group. They included a future alderman, Adam Carlyle, and Thomas de Walden, who was the chief apothecary to Westminster Abbey, as well as Chamberlain of London. By 1356, the fraternity was joined by another prosperous apothecary, John de Bovingdon, who built up a considerable estate of properties around Cheapside and Honey Lane. Now, this shows a difference in people's priorities. The dealers in spice and peppers up on Cheapside, as I've said in previous chapters, never really aligned with the ones working down on Soper's Lane, traditionally. But now they were. The loss of the franchise was obviously encouraging men who had previously not bothered with each other to seek out each other in solidarity. Londoners were having to protect themselves against new competition. Now that the Guildhall, with its mayor and its sheriffs, could no longer officially uphold the privileges of London's merchants, these professionals were now forced to rely on private and secret pressures which these fraternities could exert over their trade. These informal alliances were not just focused on the pepperers, but we're looking at them because they're a really good illustration. By 1353, the Fraternity of St. Antoinette had 60 members, probably about two-thirds of all the pepperers and spices in London. Now, it's really interesting you get a real idea of their priorities by considering which spices were not invited to join. The most conspicuous absentees were the Italians and those who had links to them. The loss of the franchise then is turning this parish fraternity into a private members' club focused on the protection of its members' interests against competition, both foreign and domestic. It's also interesting to see how this fraternity interacted with other fraternities, and we get a clue looking at the relationship between Soper's Lane and the Ropers in Dowgate. Although they had joined with the Pepperers and Spicers in 1351 to elect representatives to the Common Council, none of the Ropers belonged to the Fraternity of St. Antoine to begin with. And it's quite likely the Ropers had developed their own secret fraternity. The existence of a separate Ropers fraternity actually would explain the later date at which Ropers suddenly began to join the Fraternity of St. Antoine, and why, when they did join, they were immediately chosen to be wardens. Richard de Preston in 1354. Richard de Wickham in 1355, Bartholomew Festling in 1356. Like the four Spicers from Cheapside who joined in 53, these men, who were the most prominent merchants in the ropery, became members of the Fraternity of St. Antoinette as equals and partners, not as new members, but on their own terms. They probably came from a fraternity of ropers, and they're forging new alliances. Now, once again, I'm focusing on these guys for reasons that will become obvious, but it's fair to say that across the city, all the crafts were having to cope with this new reality. Meanwhile, the attacks upon London's businesses and merchants, blaming them for the harsh economic conditions, continued. A petition was presented to Parliament in 1354, complaining that food and victuals had trebled in price in the city, and the cause was the restrictive practices of the victuallers and the collusion of the city's government, which had just been led for 2 years by the mercer Adam Fraucies. This actually led to a measure which briefly removed the mayor and aldermen from power to correct their supposed abuses and gave power to an inquest drawn from representatives from the counties around London. Now, one of the reasons I keep going on about the pepperers here, and also why London was suffering from bad press, was that what was actually going on was the pepperers and spicers all joining together with the ropers and everything was actually causing a description in how they described their profession. And this change in description was working against the entire city. See, all those complaints against racketeers who were supposedly causing huge spikes in the price of fish, wine and other foodstuffs was pouring scorn upon these exploiters of the people who were known as engrossers in the language of the time. Unfortunately, this combination of spices, peppers and ropers forming down on Soper's Lane and in the Fraternity of St. Antoinette were beginning to refer to themselves as grossers, which was replacing titles such as pepperer and roper. The grossers in time became known as the grocers, and this is where we see the origin of that most powerful of professions in London's history. However, because they were calling themselves grocers, at the exact same time accusations were levelled against engrossers, the two names have been linked as being actually derived from the same source. They weren't. What had brought some of the spices of Cheapside and, more important, ropers to join the Fraternity of St. Antoinette was not a desire to monopolise or engross the goods of other trades, but the need mostly to protect their own trade against new competition. The other thing that brought them together, by the way, was another huge economic change that hit London within a few years of the ones that have already hit. Basically, in 1353, the king banned any Englishman from exporting wool. The ban on English merchants exporting wool was given official form in a statute which established home wool staples or wool markets and set up a whole new system of registering mercantile debts within them. Merchant trading with the staples were removed from the jurisdiction of the common law and were made subject to mercantile law. This was to be administered by the mayors of the staples, who were to be elected by the local merchants. This statute of 1353 also confirmed all the privileges which foreign merchants had been granted by the Carta Mercatoria, which we first talked about all the way back in chapter 112. The exclusion of English merchants from the wool trade was clearly intended to be a long duration ruling. The staple for London was fixed over in Westminster, and all wool intended for export had to be taken there or to one of the other staple towns, from which only foreigners could export it out. This change, coupled with the abolition of the city's franchise, were to basically make the 1350 years that became crucially important to the future shaping of the English economy, as well as the city's. London had to adjust, change, and move intelligently, so as to maintain its position as the main conduit of the kingdom's export and import trade. And if it didn't, it could return to the eras of maybe a century or so earlier, where the eastern northern ports of England were actually the main import and export locations in the country. And what was worse, these changes were bringing in newcomers to London from the rest of the country, who now had the opportunity to make cash legally in London. We know that this abolition of the city's franchise and creation of the wool staple in Westminster led to a steady flow of new immigrants to London and its suburbs from the rest of England. This migration of non-natives to London was to carry on all the way through the 1350s and actually into the 1360s, and eventually this freedom for outsiders to trade in the city all year round was actually responsible for killing off Westminster's fair. The complete suspension of the city's franchise allowed provincial wool dealers to bring their wool to London and sell it directly to European exporters instead of being forced to sell it to the citizens of the city. This measure, while cutting out the Londoners' profits, actually was sufficient to attract many Midlanders to cart their wool to London instead of somewhere like Boston. And they were also encouraged to do this because there was a war on and piracy was rife and the shortest sea routes to the continent were from London. So export figures shot up, and London managed to become the principal wood exporting location in the whole of England. Most of the other staple towns were not ports, and rather than see their wood detained in inland staples where there were few foreign merchants to bid up the price, the wool growers and middlemen sent it to London where the Italians and the Germans competed for the export of wool. But one of the side effects meant that the Europeans were now paying out more for wool, which meant to get money to pay for it, they had to increase the amount of goods they imported into London. For a time after the bankruptcy of the Bardi and the Peruzzi in the 1340s, the number of Italian residents in London had diminished, but after 1351, they flocked to the city in growing numbers. The company of the Bardi was reconstituted, and the companies of the Peruzzi and the Strozzi became active again. About 60 Florentine merchants alone have been traced in English records to the 25 years after 1350. The Hanseatic and German merchants of London Steelyard too were encouraged by home staples to increase their trade and imports into London. The concentration of overseas trade in London at the expense of any other port therefore became even more pronounced from the 1350s, with the consequence that London increased the volume of its distributive trade to the rest of the country. In the 1330s and 1340s, the annual value of its foreign imports and exports never really reached more than £8,000. But in the year that a city lost its franchise, the total went past that figure. And once foreigners had the monopoly of wool exports, the total soared to over £18,000. Even when English merchants were again allowed to export wool in 1357, the total value of the foreign trade with London went on rising until it reached a peak of over £69,000 round about the early 1370s. by which time London's going to be dealing in between two-thirds and three-quarters of all foreign trade with this country. And this coincided with a massive increase of output from the Royal Mint in the Tower of London. So even though Londoners were hit hard by losing their franchise and then not being able to export wool, there was incredible opportunity to be had. And the growth of purchasing power and the increased demand throughout the kingdom for goods imported through the city saw that London become once more the channel for foreign trade into England. There was money to be made, and groups like the Fraternity of St. Antoinette were on the ground to make this money. At first, the citizens were not the principal beneficiaries of this new money came in, as they kept petitioning for the restoration of their franchise. The franchise had been meant to keep this trade in their hands, and its suspension meant that ambitious provincial merchants were now free to compete with them. With no bar to stop them from trading or settling in the city, men who had built up some capital in Hampshire or in Warwickshire now saw new opportunities to expand their business by using their sales of wool in London to personally finance a return trade in alien imports back to their home counties. The plague had served their purpose as well by emptying properties in London and breaking down the solidarity of many of the old trading quarters, and therefore enabled the assertive newcomers to rent warehouses and cellars in whichever areas most suited their trade, and where they could escape, if need be, from the social pressures of the enfeebled fraternities and guilds of London who survived the plague. As a side effect of this, by the way, which was positive, London experienced a quick recovery in its population and a structural change in its economy. So, with all these changes going on, the actual way the members of the Fraternity of St. Antoinette, the grocers, made money also had to change. And it helps to begin explaining why they began referring to themselves as grocers. It's kind of important. Now, you see, the main growth in what these foreigners were importing into London to be able to get the funds to pay for increased buying up of English wool seems to have been chiefly in raw materials for the cloth industry, which expanded notably before the plague. Before the Black Death had turned up, about 4,500 cloths were being exported each year, and 10 years later that number was almost 12,000 and still rising at an annual rate of 18%. So just so you understand and make sure people are following here, the raw material, English wool, the English were forbidden from exporting into Europe. Only Europeans could do that. But they were bringing back product that was then being fed into the English cloth-making material, where they turned wool into garments. Now, part of this growth in English cloth can be explained by the additional taxes which the king had laid on English wool, and which encouraged the Flemings to concentrate on making finer, more expensive broadcloths because they could absorb the higher cost of it. And this created an opening for English rural industry to expand their production of coarser worsteds and kiseys, first for the domestic market and then increasingly for the European market. But to meet the demand, capital was needed. And it seems that rather than dissipate their inheritances and purchases of luxuries, many of the survivors of the plague invested their money in vacant businesses, empty holdings, and looms and raw materials necessary for the making of cloth. More profound was, while this was happening, the other changes the king introduced forced Londoners to have to think fast on their feet. See, when there was an overseas wool staple, this gave a big advantage to English merchants. Because they were exporting English wool to Bruges, with the money they made, their return cargoes began to specialise in dyes and alum, which were sold there to them by the Genoese, and these were acquired by the growing cloth industry at home. I mean, the massive investment of £2,000, each made in 1348 by Andrew Aubrey and John Hammond, in return cargoes of this kind, shows how big a trade it was. English wool exporters were able to use their profits to finance in England sales on credit of the dyes and alums, which were essential for the newly competitive English cloth market. But The prohibition of English wool exports in 1353 put an end to this and came as a double blow to the wool exporters in the fraternity. It deprived them not only of the profits of their export and import trade, but coming so soon after the loss of the franchise, it also deprived them of the means of controlling the distributive trade in raw materials to the provincial cloth industry. It's therefore really significant that from 1351, wool merchants become prominent amongst the newcomers to the fraternity of St. Antoinette. Now, we're not 100% sure because records are not that great, but it does appear that at least 8 members of the fraternity exported wool before 1350. 3 of the 9 men who joined in 1351 appear later as wool exporters, and one of them, John Langton, was important enough to be made warden of the fraternity the following year. By 52 and 53, another prominent wool merchant, Fulk Harwood, joined, and he became a warden with his fellow wool merchant, Thomas Dawsley, in November 53. Thomas Rater, who was also a wool merchant, joined the fraternity at the same time as Harwood and was warden in 1356. And all the ropers who had joined and became wardens were also wool exporters. So, as well as being pepperers and spicers, one of the reasons they were having a name change is, well, actually, they were traditionally making their money from the wool trade. And we know that some wool merchants attempted to evade the ban on exports by, you know, illegally colluding with foreigners. In 1353, a pepperer, Fulk Harwood, and the wool merchant, Thomas Alban of London, exported wool under the names of some foreign merchants. But we know about them because they were caught. How many other pepperers had similar methods, we don't know. But it did seem that the majority of them could only continue their interest in the wool trade as middlemen. But this would explain why they joined the fraternity. Because by joining this little cartel, they could create the conditions to keep prices down and give themselves some kind of informal protection against this new competition that was coming into the city. And also allowed them to specialise in getting into the business of supplying important materials to the English cloth industry, since they could no longer be part of the raw wool industry. Despite the loss of franchise and the ban of English exports of wool, the surviving certificates of credit and debt show an increase in the credit they advanced in the 1350s, of over one-third more than the previous decade. To some extent, this reflects the rising supply of money, which helped the economy to recover quickly after the plague, but most of it reflects to an increased sales in dyes, in oils, and in mordants required for the cloth industry. And this explains why from the 1350s, the pepperers on Soper's Lane began to see themselves first and foremost as grocers, general dealers in product. The birth of the London grocers. Now, for the first 5 years after that ban on English wool exports, the grocers were unable to invest their profits to any extent in the export trade. And as a result, many of those who were accustomed to export invested their funds, temporarily or otherwise, in property in London. As a group, they acquired 24 more properties than they ever sold. The wealthiest merchants also seemed to have taken advantage of the plague to buy up country estates, since there was a shortage of labour, and that meant they were going cheaply. Andrew Aubrey began building up an estate through a series of purchases near Watford in 1351. Thomas Dawsley acquired the manor of Peckham, which extended from Camberwell to Dunwich, and the manor of Wedley. Richard de Wickham acquired an estate in Herefordshire. John de Thotham, part of the manor of Coggeshall. And Bartholomew Festing, a property in Essex. 1350s, therefore, were prosperous years for these pepperers and ropers turned grocers, despite the loss of the franchise and the ban of exporting wool. This was because the foreign merchants had made London the centre of their trade, and as a consequence, had not only diverted most wool exports to it, but had increased its dominance over the distribution trade by steadily importing imports of raw materials for the cloth industry. The fraternity was ideally placed to exploit this. By the end of the decade, over 5 aldermen belonged to the fraternity of St. Antoinette, a huge number given its short existence. So the grocers' fraternity was able to adapt. but by contrast, their neighbours in Soper's Lane and in Cheapside, the Mercers, were experiencing very different fortunes, as they found their distributive and retail trade completely challenged by the Italians. The Carta Mercatoria's confirmation in 1353 had strengthened the position of the Florentines and Lucans, who increasingly settled in London. And like the industrial raw materials imported by the Genoese and distributed by the grocers, the costly silks, velvets and brocades imported by the Florentines found their chief market in London, where the foreigners had traditionally been allowed to sell them directly to the court, or the nobility, or the church. The Italians, therefore, did not need any middlemen anywhere to distribute them to provincial centres, and they had no intention of sharing their profits with London mercers. After the loss of the city's franchise, the mercers had no means of excluding Italians from the London retail market, and they also had the mortification of seeing Italian spices begin to export the English-made worsted, which the mercers traditionally sold. Squeezed by the competition, the Mercers of London led a vociferous campaign for the restoration of the franchise. Far from agreeing to it, the king instead extended his protection of the Italians and in 1356 excused them from even having to share in the burden of the city's war taxation. Now, the Mercers were joined in their protest by another powerful group, that of the Vintners, who had become in the 1340s and 1350s some of the richest merchants in London. Their enormous wealth, which they gained from the wine trade and their interest in wool exports, only increased the popular suspicion that the high prices which followed the plague were created simply by their profiteering. When the ending of the city's commercial privileges in 1351 failed to bring down the price of wine, a new statute was passed in 53 with aimed at prohibiting the, quote, engrossing and forestalling of wine, unquote, in Gascony by London-based merchants. It did nothing, by the way, to reduce the price of wine, but did reduce the vintners' profits and created great hostility towards the Gascon wine importers, who were gaining money at their expense. It also increased tension with those Italians who were being encouraged by the crown to sell sweet wine in London. The Vintners began to organise themselves into a fraternity to defend their interests, and also made common cause with other crafts whose interests had suffered from the loss of the franchise. Amongst these were many of the manufacturing crafts. The small masters found themselves, after 1351, without protection against the competition of the unenfranchised newcomers to the city, who were flouting accepted rules and standards to undercut prices and entice away apprentices and even servants. Even powerful groups such as the fishmongers, who were accustomed to monopolising the fish trade of the city, found themselves now challenged by outsiders. By the end of the decade, they too were taking their own measures to protect their trade. Throughout the 1350s, the Londoners' resentment grew against non-freemen, whether English or European, who escaped the city's burden of taxation and profited at the expense of the freemen of London. In April 1357, during the mayoralty of the Vintner, Henry Picard, the resentment and anger were expressed in a formal petition to the king for some relief. The city expounded at length the financial sacrifices it had made to finance the king since his wars had begun. They'd financed expeditions in Scotland, Gascony, Brabant, Flanders, Brittany and France. Royal purveyors had battered on them and seized carts and foods and merchandise. London had been put under the jurisdiction of neighbouring counties at one point, and that had led to men being unwilling to serve as mayor or alderman. And moreover, merchants were refusing to live in the city, and foreign merchants who took their gains out of the country were more free than the natives. They begged the king to restore their franchises, quote, before the citizens were utterly destroyed, unquote. There was, however, no response to this petition, as had been none to early ones. Even before it was drawn up, some Londoners were boiling with anger and decided to take direct action. In 1354, European merchants had petitioned Parliament for a member of the King's Council to be appointed to hear their complaints and to see that the statutes which gave them freedom of trade were observed, because they had suffered, quote, much ill use from the Londoners, unquote. And after the failure of the city's petition in 1357, a group of mercers beat the living daylights out of some Lombard merchants. And then The city's authorities either failed or delayed to seek any justice for this, and these Lombard merchants appealed to the king's council. Fines and imprisonments, though, failed to deter the more hot-headed mercers. Things were getting more intense and fractious. The lead taken by the mercers in the anti-alien movement provides a small parallel with the politics of, if you go back to 1312 and 13, when William Hackford had led the city's campaign. But this time there were no Cheapside spicers openly supporting the mercers, as the pepperers and the ropers were busy profiting from becoming grocers to really be bothered too much by the mercers' concerns. The new covenants of London were changing the politics of the city, but while some, like the grocers, found a way to profit, most of London was under the cosh. And with migrants changing the very nature of the city itself, all of this was planting dangerous seeds for the times to come. London then, in the immediate aftermath, was a city recovering from its recent past, but sowing seeds for a radically new future. Like always, it takes time for anger to grow fully. What was brewing amidst the losers from this new covenant would take about 20 years to show. And if you look at London between 1350 and 1356, what you see is a city on the surface that seems the same. I mean, it's a city that grows and changes. It's a city where there's always something new being built. In 1353, we have the establishment of the wool staple in Westminster. We saw the building of a new hall for wool trading and chambers being erected, together with a landing stage and a warehouse. But then we see the king complaining that workmen engaged on works there and in the palace of Westminster had of late deserted their jobs and gone to work in the city instead, where presumably the pay was better. He threatened anyone who employed these men would be imprisoned in the Tower of London. What work was going on in London? Well, the rebuilding of Austin Friars over in Old Broad Street. It was a city where more complaints were raised about the stench of the River Fleet, same as it ever was. But things were building, even if London was about to be greeted with extraordinary good news. And I'll cover that next episode. Thanks for listening. Hope you could follow along. Much going on. The grocers are here and the mercers are screwed. I'll be back again next week for another episode of The Story of London. Story of London runs without adverts, as you may have noticed, and that's deliberate. I just, you know, I think the podcast is dense enough without adding an advert halfway through. The only way it survives and maintains itself is due to contributions from well-meaning and wonderful fans and listeners. You can make a contribution via the Buy Me a Coffee link I have put up somewhere around the bump for this podcast. This allows you to make a one-off contribution or even, gasp, become a member. All funds go towards paying for hosting fees and the rights for music that are used in each episode. Okay, that's enough for me. Hope you had a good week, and I'll see you next week in The Story of London. Thanks. Bye.